This is C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast. This week, political scientist Barbara Walter, author of the book How Civil Wars Start, examines the warning signs that often precede civil wars.
The groups that tend to start these wars are not the weakest groups. They're not the poorest groups. They're not immigrant groups. They're not the most discriminated against. The groups that tend to start these wars are the groups that had once been politically dominant.
She's interviewed by Smith College Middle East Studies Chair Stephen Heidemann.
Welcome, Barbara Walter. It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk with you today. Your book has generated an astonishing national debate about where we are as a country today during a moment of quite extraordinary polarization and division. And in the book, you advance this quite controversial claim that the U.S. is closer to civil war than many of us would like to think or believe. And what I thought it would make sense to do as we get launched is give you a chance to simply lay out what your argument is in broad terms, and then we can dig into bits and pieces of it as we go along.
Yeah, so my argument comes from studying civil wars for the last 30 years. I've looked at all regions, all countries that have experienced civil wars since the end of World War II, and there have been over 200 of them. And one of the things that we've learned is that they tend to break out in similar ways, and the same factors emerge in the lead up to these wars, no matter where they happen. And then in 2017, I was invited to serve on the U.S. government's task force. They have a task force called the Political Instability Task Force, and I served on that task force until the end of last year. And the goal of that task force was to come up with a predictive model to try to predict where around the world countries would experience instability and political violence. And so there are a bunch of experts on civil wars like myself, political scientists, anthropologists, sociologists, and then there were a bunch of data analysts who were in charge of the model. And the experts on violence were asked about the factors that they thought might put countries at greater risk of violence. And we put those factors into this model. So that included things like poverty. It included measures of income inequality, measures of how ethnically diverse a country was, how big it was, how much rough terrain a country had. We put over 30 different variables into this model. And to our great surprise, only two came out highly predictive. We weren't expecting that. The first was a measure called anocracy. And anocracy is just a fancy term for a country whose government is a partial democracy. It's neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. It's something in between. So you could think of it as, for example, a country has free and fair elections. Everybody's allowed to vote. A new president is elected. But that president, once in office, doesn't have many checks and balances on his or her power. So you have elements of democracy, the free and fair elections, and you have elements of sort of authoritarian rule, a very powerful president. The second factor was whether a country's citizens were organized politically, not around ideology, not the left, the right, the issues relevant to each of those camps, but around identity, racial, ethnic, or religious identity, and whether those parties became predatory. Their goal was to get in office, not to share power, but to stay in power. So again, I'm on this task force. We are only looking at countries outside the United States. In fact, we were not allowed to look at the United States, talk about the United States, and early on, it didn't occur to us to even ever think about the United States. But then as time is going on, I'm looking at the United States, I'm looking at my own country, and I'm realizing that these two factors are in fact emerging here, and they've been emerging at a surprisingly fast rate.
Yeah, we have certainly seen an increase in violence and political violence in the United States over the past several years. And a lot of the debate around your book seemed to surface in particular on the anniversary of the January 6th insurgency here in Washington, and that's not a surprise.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of terms that have been applied to actors who engage in violence. It's seen as a form of insurgency. It's seen as a form of terrorism. What do you think talking about these trends in terms of civil war helps us to see that we might not otherwise focus on to the same degree?
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why it's so hard for most Americans to conceive of a second civil war here, why this message took so long to resonate with the American public, is because they're thinking about an 1860 version of a civil war. They're thinking about all those images that they have of two armies meeting on a big battlefield. They each have uniforms. They're dragging cannons. They're engaging each other. And that's just not the type of civil war that's going to happen here. And in fact, that's not really the type of modern civil war that you tend to see anymore. The modern civil wars that we see, especially against governments with militaries that are very strong, like the United States, or, you know, think about the provisional IRA fighting the British government and the British military, big, powerful military, or think about Hamas fighting the Israeli government, whose military is also extremely strong. So in those situations, the type of civil war is more of an insurgency. It tends to be very decentralized, and decentralized on purpose, fought by multiple different militia groups, paramilitary groups, and sometimes they're working together and sometimes they're actually competing with each other. The last thing they want to do is engage soldiers and the military. If they do that, it's a battle that they cannot win. And so they turn to unconventional methods, domestic terrorism, where they're targeting civilians, or they're targeting infrastructure, or they're targeting opposition leaders. Or judges, perhaps, who are not sympathetic to their cause, or they're using guerrilla warfare, where you have bombs set off in particular places, hit and run attacks. Those are the types of civil wars that we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. And if the United States has a civil war, that's what we're likely to see here.
Now, you mentioned that countries that fall into this category of regime type called anocracy, this intermediate category, neither full democracy nor full autocracy, that those are the cases that are most vulnerable to this descent into violence, into this new form of civil war you've described.
Yeah.
What is it about anocracies that make them so vulnerable?
Yeah. So the relationship that we see is actually called an inverted U-shape. If you look at full autocracies on the left side of the axis and full democracies on the right side of the axis, both of those types of governments rarely experience civil war. All of the civil war happens in the middle, and so it has this inverted U-shaped relationship between the type of political regime and the risk of violence. And so the question is, why is that the case? Full democracies, strong liberal democracies, don't tend to experience civil war because their citizens are generally pretty happy. They don't have a lot of grievances. And even if some groups in those democracies have grievances, they're conventional political ways to address them. They don't have to turn to violence because they have alternate means to try to effect change. If you look at full autocracies, so think about North Korea. These are the most autocratic countries. Saudi Arabia, Iran. Those tend not to experience civil wars, not because the people are happy. They're not. It's because they have no opportunity to rebel. Even if they wanted to try to mobilize to challenge the government, those countries tend to be quite good at repressing dissent. And so you never see rarely see insurgencies emerge. But the governments in the middle, these anocracies, they're not fully democratic, so citizens aren't fully satisfied with these regimes. They would like to see more democracy. They're not complacent. That's not the word. They're not super happy with these regimes, but they're also weak regimes. These are often regimes that are in transition. Leadership is changing more rapidly. Institutions are breaking down or are being broken down. And so the repressive arm of the state in these autocracies, in order to repress dissent that would emerge because people are unhappy with elements of the government, that doesn't exist to the same extent. So you have both groups who are unhappy with the status quo, and they also have the opportunity to organize resistance to a government that, at that point, is often relatively weak.
Yeah, so you have grievances, you have opportunity, and you have limited capacity to respond on the part of a government that may be in flux, that may be fluid.
Exactly.
It's the case, of course, that some countries that are consolidated autocracies do experience civil war. Some of the examples in your book, Syria, for example, is clearly a consolidated autocracy and yet experienced civil war, closer to the 1860 variety than the type that you're describing. But what is it about the United States in particular? You've mentioned that there's been a shift in where the U.S. stands on the rankings that define whether a country is a democracy, anocracy, or autocracy. But what is it about the United States that puts us in that dangerous category?
Yeah, so the same measure that the task force uses to measure autocracy, it's a measure that was developed by a nonprofit organization in Virginia called the Center for Systemic Peace. And every year they assign a number to every country related to this autocracy variable. The United States, it's a scale that goes from negative 10, most autocratic type of government, to positive 10, most democratic type of government. For a very long time, the United States was at positive 10. And in 2016, the Center for Systemic Peace downgraded the United States to positive 8. And it did this in part because international election monitors who were monitoring the 2016 election deemed it free but not entirely fair. In 2019, it downgraded the U.S. The U.S.'s democracy score once again to plus 7. And it did this as a result of the executive branch refusing to respond to subpoenas by the legislative branch. And here in the United States, the biggest check on executive power is Congress. And if the president doesn't respond to this tool of Congress to try to keep presidential behavior in line, then that clearly indicates that the president is much more powerful than Congress. And that is not how our system was originally designed. We were not supposed to have what Arthur Schlesinger a few years back called an imperial president. But we now have an executive branch that is significantly more powerful than all the other branches. And then by the end of Trump's presidency, the center downgraded the U.S. democracy to plus 5. Negative 5 to plus 5 is the autocracy zone. And that put the United States in that zone for the first time since 1800. So here I am. I'm watching U.S. democracy decline. I see it go towards the middle zone. I understand that that this is not a neutral situation, that the middle zone is where a lot of instability and violence happens. And then, of course, I'm thinking about that second factor. Does the U.S. have ethnic factions or an ethnic faction? And by the definition that the Center for Systemic Peace uses, do we have parties or a political party that is based predominantly around ethnic, religious, or racial identity? And is it predatory? The answer is yes, we do now have that. As late as 2008, White voters were almost equally split between the Democratic and the Republican Party. That shifted when Obama was elected, and that's when the white working class, whose traditional ideological home was in the Democratic Party, they began shifting towards the Republican Party. And today, the Republican Party is 90% white. And not only is it catering almost exclusively to just one racial group and religious group here in the United States, but its intent is to attempt to gain power using almost any means. And that is, in essence, predatory.
Yeah. That has some interesting implications that I hope we can come back to later. But I wanted to stick with this anocracy theme for a moment and yeah. where the U.S. falls on that spectrum. The data can sometimes be contradictory. There are a number of different indexes of the quality of democracy, yeah. and you mentioned some of them in the book. Freedom House issues one that's widely used, and so does another organization based in Europe called VDEM. Yeah. Neither of those indices have drawn quite as stark a conclusion about the position of the U.S. as the Polity Index has. And in addition, this year, I happened to check just this morning, the U.S. is back up to +8 on the Polity Index. So, you know, I'd be interested in how you read these differences. And at the same time, if I can just for a minute longer, we continue to see very, very troubling indicators about violence trends in the United States and the potential for violence, even as the Polity score has gone up. For example, a recent political violence database, the ACLED database, you may know it, just issued a report on the anniversary of the January 6th uprising that said that pro-Trump demonstrations continue post-presidency and are more likely to be armed, and that armed pro-Trump demonstrations disproportionately come to legislative grounds. So, you know, we have so much that we need to take into account in thinking about where we are. How do you make sense of this mass of data that you have to sort through?
Yeah. So I'm gonna answer the first two questions first, which was, we have these different data sets, and the U.S. was just upgraded to +8. And then if we could, turn to the question about violence after that, that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. So there's at least, there's four major data sets that measure democracy. There's the Polity data set, which comes from the Center for Systemic Peace, and that's the one that most conflict scholars use. It's been around the longest. It looks at the greatest number of countries. It looks at both autocracies and democracies. It looks at all countries. There's the Freedom House data set that you talked about. There's the VDEM data set that's run out of Sweden, and that's short for Varieties of Democracy data set. There's a data set run by the Economist Intelligence Unit, and there's actually a fifth data set by the International Institute, it's IDEA, for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, Accountability, something like that. And the way to think about those data sets is that they all measure democracy in slightly different ways. Or another way to look at it is they're all interested in different aspects of democracy. And so that's what they tend to focus on. Just to give you an example, Freedom House is really interested in individual rights and freedoms. That's where they hone in on. They're interested in how good is freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech in every country around the world. And so that's what they are measuring. And by those measures, the U.S. has declined in some elements, but has actually remained relatively strong. The Polity data set out of the Center for Systemic Peace, that's really interested in the institutions of democracy, the checks and balances. It looks very carefully at, executive constraints. So it's it, and it kind of comes from a theory that you have for what you think is most important in a polity. Do you think what's most important is individual rights and freedoms? Then that's what you, your organization, is going to focus on. If you think what's most important is the strength of the institutions, so no matter who comes to power, whether it's a strong man or a true Democrat, that person will be constrained by the institutions, then you focus on institutions. And that's what the Center for Systemic Peace with this polity variable focuses on. And then, you know, the other one, varieties of democracy. It's really interested in all the different types of democracies we have out there. And there's myriad types. And it looks to see about which of the features of the many, many features of different types of democracies, how they're doing across countries.
Yeah.
I don't know why the task force used the Center for Systemic Pieces, and I wasn't there when the model was first crafted. It could be that they included measures from all of the data sets that existed at the time on democracy. It could be that they included measures of from Freedom House. The measure that came out significant was this polity measure, this anocracy variable. And so that suggests that it's something about the institutions that really put a country at risk. And this gets to what I was talking about earlier. You know, we think anocracies are often just a proxy for a weak, unstable government. And it's weak because the institutions are weak. It's weak because the institutions are not really constraining the power of the executive. And that is the measure that was most predictive. And then the plus, your second question, which was the U.S. was just upgraded to +8. The Center for Systemic Peace updated its data. It does this every year. It did it the first week of January this year, looking back on 2021. And the U.S. was upgraded from a +5 to a +8 as a result of the peaceful transfer of power to the Biden administration. And as a result of the Biden administration adhering to the rule of law. So that takes us out of the anocracy zone. But again, you know, we've seen how quickly, actually, we can backslide. And we know, for example, that Trump would very much like to come to power. We know that many in the Republican Party support him. And if not him, someone who will be very much like him. And of course, you know, his goal is to get back into power and to make it more difficult for the opposition to win future elections and make it more difficult for the results of those elections to actually be implemented. So,
yeah. Right. Well, mentioning the possibility of a return to power of Donald Trump, I think, reminds us that there are multiple pathways that the U.S. could follow toward equally depressing outcomes.
Yes.
One of which might involve the kind of escalation in violence that you focus on in the book, but the other could happen through electoral outcomes, through the capture of institutions by a political party whose commitment to democracy is very, very much in question. And in fact, some of the pushback that you've received about the argument is that the success that right-wing Republicans have had in capturing political institutions at the local and state level, in changing the rules of the game around the management and supervision of elections, gerrymandering political districts to prevent the opposition from gaining power, that this is a pathway that is far more likely to be the one that could move the U.S. Well out of the democracy range within a polity score, but without the kind of violence that you've speculated about in the book. What's your sense about these alternative pathways, and why did you decide to put so much emphasis on the more violent of those pathways?
Well, it's different types of violence, right? So It is true that if the Republicans were able to dismantle our democracy, if they were able really to create a one-party state where Republicans are always in power and there is really no way for the opposition to compete effectively anymore, if we did become an autocratic regime, we might still hold elections, but it would really have no effect on the outcome. Singapore does that. If that were to happen, we probably wouldn't have a civil war, but we would have minority rule with a majority of the citizens deeply, deeply, deeply unhappy. And like other autocratic regimes that are able to avoid outright civil war, the way they do this is with heavy, heavy repression. And so there's a different type of state-sponsored violence that occurs. And again, these countries are at lower risk of war, but when war does happen, it is explosive, it is brutal, That is not a better path to go down over the long term.
No, I certainly agree with that. In fact, I wondered at times in reading your book, which emphasizes appropriately, I think, the role of the right in the United States as a driver of extremism and potential violence, actual violence. You do also reference groups on the left that you see as playing something of a similar role. You talk a little bit about Antifa. You talk a little bit about some other movements that have begun to take up arms on the grounds of self-defense against threats from the right. Are there conditions in which the right captures institutions and moves the country toward a single-party regime in which you could imagine that the reaction, a violent reaction, would actually originate among those who oppose that kind of system?
Absolutely. So I guess the way when you look at the cases historically, and you especially look at the ethnic civil wars, one of the things that we've learned is that the groups that tend to start these wars are not the weakest groups. They're not the poorest groups. They're not immigrant groups. They're not the most discriminated against. The groups that tend to start these wars are the groups that had once been politically dominant, but are either in decline or they anticipate that they will lose power in the system in the future. They're the ones who have this deep sense of resentment. They're the ones who will try all sorts of dirty tactics to try to maintain their hold on power. One of those dirty tactics would be to dismantle the democracy and put themselves in power. And of course, once they do that, the goal is to exclude everybody else. And so when we look at civil wars as well, it is also the politically excluded groups that will eventually organize. So if, for example, and you see this already today, if the Republicans lose the 2024 elections, the Republican voters are going to believe that it was stolen again. It will only confirm their belief that the current system is illegitimate and is structured against them, and it will push more of them into the hands of violent extremists in their group who have been telling them, who have been telling them that violence is the only way for them to gain back control. If they are successful at doing that, and they then shut out a majority of Americans from power, then that the left is going to have incentives to mobilize as well. But I don't think the left is going to start this, in part because time is on their side, given the current system. They know that demographically they will be the majority by 2045. All they have to do is wait, and they will have the votes to dominate the system. And so right now they have no incentives to start a war, whereas a segment of the white population who is deeply, deeply concerned about this demographic transition, who sees this as an existential threat, time is not on their side. And so that's why I think they would be the ones to initiate war first.
Yeah, I think that that's an important message, because we often get what I personally view as false equivalencies drawn between groups that I think are small and not terribly meaningful in terms of their capacity to damage the system. Groups like Antifa, for example, which has become a favorite stalking horse for the right, and far more threatening, far more capable and violent groups on the right. And so I think it is important to accentuate the distinctions between these two camps in a polarized political system. Even under polarization, not all actors have the same proclivity or incentive to engage to engage in violence. And I think that's important to note. You know, one of the things that you review in the book that I think is quite interesting, beyond the general conditions that leave us concerned about the prospects of civil war, is what some of the specific conditions are, what some of the specific triggers might be that could induce this majority of those on the right who are themselves probably unsettled by what they see as the extremists in their ranks and who are not prepared to go that extra step and participate in any kind of organized violence. What it would take to reach a tipping point where some kind of cascade could occur that would draw many, many more of those who are unhappy with the system from the right into the ranks of those who are willing to use violence. And it would be useful to hear you talk a bit about what some of those specific triggers might be.
Yeah. So I have a chapter in the book about these triggers, and it's called When Hope is Lost. And I think that really gets at the trigger. Countries that are autocracies and that have ethnic factions often are like that for many, many years. And so having those two underlying conditions doesn't explain the timing of the outbreak of civil war. If those conditions exist year after year, then why does it happen in 2048 and not in 2022? And again, you know, the cases that the civil wars that have happened historically really tell us about what the triggers tend to be. And it tends to be, as I said, when people lose hope. And they tend to lose hope at least in two ways. One, if they're in a democracy and if they keep losing elections. And really, a loss in election is just is hard evidence to your average citizen that their party can't win. Their party is shut out of power. And I do think the 2020 elections, for example, were devastating to the Republicans. They invested heavily in a ground game. They turned out the vote. They did everything they could to get as many Republicans to the polls as they could, and they still lost by almost 8 million votes. This tells them very clearly that they don't have the votes to compete in this system. And again, when you start to have Republican leaders perpetuate this lie that the election was stolen from them, that the system is rigged against them, people will believe that, especially if every media outlet that they tap into is telling them the same thing. They will believe that. And of course, there's an incentive for their leadership to do that, because they want their people to lose hope in this current system, because they don't want this current system to continue to exist. So that is one trigger. It's a series of losses in elections. And then the second trigger, which we haven't seen here yet, but I could see this happening, is if that group decides it's going to protest. It's going to, maybe we have seen a little bit of this. It's going to go out in the street and peacefully protest. you know, you could argue that the 2017 Charlottesville rally was a peaceful protest by the far right demanding change. And if those protests have no effect, if you don't see any change as a result of those protests, if if you don't see, you know, for example, the Charlottesville protesters wanted, you know, they basically want an end to immigration. They wanted the wall to be built. They're not seeing that. Their chants were, we will not be replaced. We will not be replaced. And instead, what happened is they lost their jobs. Their employers saw videos of them on TV and fired them. The FBI began to, you know, infiltrate their groups and question them, and some of them were arrested. They got deplatformed from social media. So here they were doing what they thought was working within the system. They're not using violence. They're protesting, and it's their right to protest. And not only did nothing happen, but personally they were harmed as a result. And these are the types of events that turn people away from nonviolent means and push them into the hands of the more violent extremists in their group.
Well, yeah, I guess I'd say that those who participated in Charlottesville and those who suffered the consequences of their actions there had crossed the line from what most would view as legitimate protest into something else, and that they represent a very, very small minority. But your bigger issue about the 2020 elections as a demonstration yeah. to mainstream Republicans that despite all of their efforts, they failed to reelect Donald Trump, is a very interesting example as well, because on so many levels, Republicans succeeded in 2020. Yeah. And we have this irony around the big lie in which Republicans who won their own races are arguing that the elections they participated in were fraudulent and carried out without integrity, and so we have to think, in my view at least, about how hopelessness is manufactured, and yes. reproduced and disseminated. And you do talk a bit about social media in the book, and it would be interesting, I think, to reflect a bit on the extent to which this condition of hopelessness, which I agree with you completely, can be an extraordinarily powerful motivator to participate in extremist forms of politics, how that perception is constructed and sustained through social media and through traditional media as well, through television networks that are so actively engaged in creating the impression of hopelessness.
Yeah. So I talk in the book about people that political scientists call ethnic entrepreneurs. Ethnic entrepreneurs are oftentimes politicians, but they could be media titans, they could be business leaders. These are individuals who recognize that if they could somehow create a sense of threat, create a sense of victimhood amongst an ethnic or a racial group, and convince them that they're under threat and need to band together, and not just band together, but they need to band together under the leadership of an ethnic entrepreneur, that those citizens will follow those ethnic entrepreneurs no matter what. Slobodan Milosevic was a perfect example of this. He was a communist during the Soviet era. In Yugoslavia. He was a member of the Communist Party. He was in power as a result. And then the Soviet Union disseminates. And Yugoslavs quickly decide that they want to create a democracy in their country. And Milosevic knows he wants to keep power. He wants to stay in power. But he also knows that Yugoslavs don't like communists. And they know that he's a communist. And if he runs as a communist, they'll never vote for him. And he was a very savvy strategic person. And he was thinking about, you know, how could he get enough votes to get in power? And he realized that Serbs were the biggest ethnic group in Yugoslavia at the time. and he was an ethnic Serb. And so he started to just disseminate this propaganda on state radio, on state TV. He crafted this consistent narrative that he just pounded into the heads of Serbs, that that Serbs had to band together. If they didn't band together, the Croats were going to do it. And in fact, the Croats were doing it. And if the Croats got into power, they would throw Serbs out of their jobs, out of government, out of the military. And in fact, they might go as far as what some of them did in World War II, which was to slaughter Serbs. And it was a very, very effective strategy in this time of uncertainty, when Yugoslavia was an anocracy, when things were changing very quickly, when their new government was really quite weak. Serbs didn't really know who to trust. There was a deep element of insecurity. And they gathered behind Milosevic, and he was catapulted back into power. And so you see that happening, where capturing the media is really, really important for elites. Who want political power. It's really important for them to capture the narrative in order to gain the support of average citizens. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you can do this through traditional television, through cable, through local news, but social media is really unbelievably powerful, and it's really, really powerful. Not only because you can place whatever material you want on social media, but more importantly, because the recommendation engines, the algorithms, choose the most incendiary material, the material that triggers a fight and flight response, fear, insecurity, hate. It takes those pieces of information, that content, and it magnifies it. It disseminates it wildly. And the reason it disproportionately favors that type of content is because the business model for social media companies is to keep people engaged on their cell phones and on their devices as long as possible. And they have now figured out that the material that keeps people engaged the longest is the more incendiary one, a type of material. It's the material that triggers the oldest parts of our brain, the fight and flight response. People not only read that at four times more than calming information, but they share it significantly more than material that's more positive.
Right. And one of the other things exposure to social media seems to cultivate, unfortunately, is a very deep resistance to the facts. And we see that over and over again. We have this sense of being threatened, of being at risk, of vulnerability on the part of a constituency within the United States, at least, that continues to hold a dominant share of political, economic, social, and cultural power. And so there's the irony that social media creates this sort of insular alternative universe in which facts about the privileged status of those who are being mobilized against our democracy becomes almost impossible to communicate and penetrate. And you know, that puts an interesting spin on this question of the downgrading in social economic status, political status of communities that are the constituencies for these political, for these ethnic identity entrepreneurs, because it seems as if economic factors, the extent to which these communities have actually, in their own view at least, slipped on socioeconomic grounds. In your book, you actually tend to discount the importance of economic factors, and so we have this role of a community, a social group that feels it's losing status, that its position in society is at risk, and yet at the same time, your sense is, and I know it's based on the data you use, but your sense is that economic factors aren't especially important in shaping those perceptions. Why is that?
So we don't exactly know. Early quantitative studies on the causes of civil war found poverty significantly related to the outbreak of civil war again and again and again. So all of us thought, well, you know, it's the poor countries that tend to experience civil war. And then as we collected more and better data, as we included more nuanced variables in our models, especially related to the quality of governance, what we found was that when you put in measures of the rule of law, for example, or, you know, how strong the rule of law is in a country, or a measure of how competitive is the political system, if you included these measures of good governance, the poverty variable was no longer significant. And that was a surprise. And we suspect that the reason the poverty variable dropped out was because poor countries often have bad governments. And the governments aren't delivering services. The economy isn't flourishing in those countries because the government is poor and there's high levels of corruption. And so it's not poverty per se that's driving people to rebel. It's the quality of the government that's driving people to rebel. And then, you know, there have been so many studies to try to understand the role of economic variables, income inequality. There's so many studies, and the results are mixed. And in fact, in one of the big studies that was done by James Fearon, who's a professor at Stanford, he actually found that there was an inverse relationship between income inequality and civil war, that the lower the level of income inequality in a country, the higher the risk of civil war. So I don't talk a lot about the economic variables because either they haven't been significant or we have these mixed results, and it's not really clear at this point in time what conclusion to draw from that. Right. But what we do know, and these are more recent studies, is that if you have a downgraded group, so a group that is politically losing power or has lost power, and they then suffer an economic crisis that compounds that loss, that makes those groups more likely to organize and turn to violence. So there does seem to be a compounding effect when you add, you know, economic loss to the equation.
Yeah, that narrative fits quite well in the Middle East in the protest that broke out in 2011, for example, where we know from interviewing and data that it was not the rural poor who were the early risers in those protests. It was the urban middle class, which had experienced downward social mobility over the preceding decade. And you talk a lot, you emphasize very heavily rural-urban divides and the difference between the outlook, the culture, the lifestyle, the political preferences of those in cosmopolitan cities, which are typically better off, and those in the countryside who have fewer economic opportunities, fewer opportunities for upward mobility. That's a global condition, apparently, but does it manifest itself in distinctive ways in the U.S.?
Oh, that's a good question. Does it manifest itself in distinctive ways? In some ways, what we see here is more troubling. In the book, I talk about super factions. So factions that are not only based on ethnicity, but are also based on religion and are also based on a geographic, an urban-rural split. So when you have parties really splitting along all three of these lines, where one is white, Christian, predominantly rural, and one is non-white, a mix of religions, and predominantly urban, that tends to be particularly combustible. And really the mechanism that underlies the radicalization of one of these groups is resentment. It's resentment at declining status. It's watching coastal elites in urban areas, or you know, worse yet, you see, you know, immigrants coming from China or India, for example, getting very high paying jobs, living the American dream that you and your children are not living, and also seeing that you are no longer able to compete in this new economy, and that you have no chance to compete. And it creates this deep sense of resentment and anger. And that can translate into a rejection of this system and support for more extreme groups.
Yeah, and it seems to me as well that institutions like the Electoral College, for example, that amplify
Yes.
rural votes and rural constituencies give those kinds of resentments added leverage within the electoral
Yes.
system too.
Yes.
You know, we have about 8 or 9 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure we took the time to talk with you about some of your thoughts relating to how to stop civil wars. The
yeah.
book is called How They Start, But How We Can Keep Them From Happening.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about that
yeah.
as well.
So the big picture is this. On the task force, we know that countries that have these two factors, that are anocracies, that are partial democracies with ethnic factions, are at about a 4% annual risk of civil war. That seems small, but it's not. Every year that those conditions continue to exist, every year that the government doesn't strengthen its democracy, every year that that an ethnic faction doubles down on racial politics, the risk increases. So that after 30 years, the risk of political violence in a country with those two features is over 100%. It's very similar to the risk of smoking. You know, I can, if I started smoking today, my risk of dying of lung cancer or a related disease would be very small. But if I continue to smoke for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, my risk of dying of something related to smoking would be quite high. And so what's, I think, so valuable about knowing these two factors is that it gives us time to turn things around. It tells us we're not on the precipice about to fall over. But if we continue in this space, if we continue on this path, or if it actually gets worse, then the risk will just continue to increase until eventually it will happen. And so what do you do about it? You know, one, get the word out. Which seems simple, but until recently it was not simple. I've talked to so many people who have lived through civil wars in places like Sarajevo and Kiev and in Baghdad, and they all say the same thing. they say that they didn't see it coming. They were just going about their daily business. Yeah, there was. They would hear about an attack somewhere on the other side of the city. Or they would hear maybe about, you know, a paramilitary group organizing somewhere, you know, in a rural area. But they didn't either take it seriously, or they thought it was an isolated, unimportant fact. And they just kept going to their jobs and taking care of their families. And then suddenly it was too late and war had broken out. And so... so just getting the word out and making people aware that there is a cancer growing in our midst. And of course, the far right, especially violent extremist groups, they want the element of surprise. They want to be able to organize in the shadows. They don't want people to know, so that they have time to plan a strategy and an attack. And so getting the word out and having not only American citizens but our politicians aware of it is very important. The second thing is regulate social media. It's probably the easiest thing we could do. And I'm not talking about regulating content. Let people put whatever information they want on the web, but don't allow the big social media companies to design algorithms that disseminate the most divisive, the most hate-filled material, because it clearly is dividing our society, and it clearly is leading to a rise of ethnic nationalism and extremism. And then, you know, the third is, you know, strengthen our democracy. Full liberal democracies don't tend to experience civil wars. If we have a strong democracy, which we do not have currently, we will not have to worry about this anymore.
Yeah, and there are so many other topics I'd love to talk about with you, including what that recommendation implies about U.S. democracy promotion policy, whether we should be encouraging countries to transition around the world if it means moving through a stage of anocracy, what it implies about President Biden's agenda to try to strengthen democracy in the United States. But I wanted to close, Barbara, by recalling how you ended the book, which was with a very moving account of a discussion you had with your husband. About whether the U.S. had actually arrived at a point that might make it necessary to think about an alternative, about whether it was time to leave the U.S. And when you mention the element of surprise and the uncertainty about where things might be headed and not really knowing whether we've reached a tipping point, all of those are factors that I think have shaped similar kinds of conversations around a lot of dining room tables. You concluded that you're going to stay. You're here and you're going to stay. And I just wonder if you could speak to that for a moment, because I found it very, very compelling.
Yeah. So my parents are immigrants. My husband's an immigrant. My sister-in-law is an immigrant. We are an immigrant family. We have the luxury of having multiple different passports as a result. And, you know, I've studied conflict my whole life. I've traveled to conflict areas. I'm used to thinking about, in the book, I call it Plan B. Okay, if something bad happens while we're here, what do we do? And we started thinking about that here after the 2020 elections, when it looked like Trump was going to make a push to try to overturn them. And we had a long discussion, and both my husband and I, we just couldn't conceive of leaving. I'm going to get teary. We love this country. It is where we want to be. We love its diversity. It is going to be the first big democracy to go through this transition from white majority rule to white minority rule. But other white countries are going to follow us, and they're going to have to go through it as well. And so the U.S. is going to be a model for how to do this. And you know, we are going to do everything that we can to help with this transition, show the world how you can come through it and be better on the other end. And we're just going to stay, and we're going to fight with words and with research and with data.
Well, the good news, Barbara, is that you're not alone. There are many of us who share those sentiments, and we will be working together toward the same end. Thank you very, very much. It's been wonderful to have this chance to talk with you and to learn a bit more about your book and your thinking about where the United States is headed in the coming years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, listen to C-SPAN's podcast about books. Learn about the latest nonfiction books and best-selling authors. In each episode, we report on bestseller lists and book reviews from around the country. You'll also hear authors talking about their latest books and insider interviews with nonfiction book publishing industry experts.